Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots non-profit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on kx935.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
Welcome to the Friendship Show here on KX93.5. My name is Mark Miller. I'm here with my co-host, Amanda Pointer.
Hello, hello.
You're really rocking the blues this morning.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm kind of feeling it.
Nice, nice. Yeah, you're a little bit out of control. All right. Our guest this morning in the studio is Dr. Randy Bell. Good morning, Dr. Bell.
Good morning, Mark, and good morning, Amanda.
There you are. Thank good you so morning. Much, sir. Thanks for coming in so early.
Sure.
You were in Thailand last night.
I was. The miracles of modern flight.
I love it when guests fly in to be in the show.
That's so cool.
I wouldn't miss it.
How was your experience?
It was off the hook because I've traveled quite a bit. I've traveled 7 continents, and I think I saved the best for last with Thailand. It's just so amazing.
Really? You were enjoying yourself a little bit, but you had business overseas in the area?
Yeah, I had some business. I have a case in Malaysia, and I thought, well, while I'm in the neighborhood, my wife and I went to Hong Kong, and we went to Thailand.
You kind of have to when you're there. I mean, you have to take advantage of the perks that your job offers, right?
Yeah, it's so far such a long flight that you think while you're there, you got to plan in a few days.
Actually, I have to say, and there's you can never fit it all in, right?
We did Hong Kong on a 9-hour layover. You know, you just fit it in, you just work it.
Nice, that's nice though, right? Let's hop in a cab, hop on a bus, let's go see what Hong Kong looks like.
Yeah, trains, planes, and automobiles. My wife's super cool. I mean, you know, we just go for it.
I always think though that I can do more, right? Like one time, like my brother was stationed in Korea. Was he in Korea? Yeah, he was stationed in Korea, right? And so I went over to Korea to see him, and then you think that, well, while you're in Korea, then like I got to go to China. I got to go to Japan.
Yeah,
you
know, it's like, yeah.
You better get it all while you're here, because who knows the next time you're going to be in Korea.
Yeah, who knows?
All right. Dr. Bell, you are the founder of Landmark Research Group, yes?
Right here in Laguna Beach. Right here, I am.
Okay, right here in Laguna Beach. And Landmark Research Group, a lot of your experience is in what you describe as damage economics. Can you tell us what damage economics is?
Sure. Damage economics is a study. The legal term is diminution of value. When there's a disaster, a lot of things are going on. But one of the things that go on are, of course, legal claims and insurance claims. And there needs to be a process to measure what that damage is. So with the World Trade Center and Hurricane Katrina, BP oil spill, O.J. Simpson, JonBenet Ramsey, all those cases I worked on, they caused damage to real estate. That was associated with those events, and I measured those damages.
You've consulted on all of those cases.
And hundreds of others, yes.
Wow.
Right? I mean, those are just the super, super big ones, right?
Right.
How do you then, so for 9/11, then you go into New York City and you say, this is what I estimate the cost of this damage to be to the community?
Basically, yes. My client with the World Trade Center was the Lower Manhattan Redevelopment Corporation, which is the entity that owns the site where the towers sat. And they retained me to measure the damage. And also, they were building a museum, so I did a whole economic study of the museum and the memorial site, which took me to, you know, speaking of Asia, I went to look at Hiroshima, the memorial there. I went to Oklahoma City. I went to memorials literally all over the world in my research to see what would be the best process for moving forward with the World Trade Center site.
Really?
Yeah, went all over the place.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's really fascinating.
Yes, it is.
What did you, in terms of damage, the economic impact on the community of what you were studying, what was your estimate?
Well, I didn't do the appraisals of the towers before 9/11. A local appraiser did that. Her name is Ruth Agnese. But I from memory, I think they were $1 billion apiece. And, of course, they both came down. My role in that particular case was the value of the property as a museum. When you have a museum and you have a memorial, because they generate money through the bookstores and the admission costs, there is an economic value, and I had to compute all of that. It's getting complicated, but that's essentially the essence of it.
Right. What was the total?
I don't remember the numbers, and if I did, I it's all confidential between me and the client. But good thing,
oh, really?
I just can't remember. But it was a lot of money, obviously. It was hundreds of millions of dollars.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
You consulted on the Heaven's Gate mass suicide.
I did. I often am asked, you know, what's the most bizarre case I worked on? I think that one takes the cake because you had 39 people in a house in San Diego that committed mass suicide. And the owner of the house, Sam Kuchas Fahani, thought he was renting the house to some religious monks. And he had no idea that they had this bizarre plan. And I'd never really seen how a cult operated, but I spent enormous amounts of time in that house, and I saw how Doe brainwashed the people. There was eavesdropping and spying going on. Every nook and cranny of that house had, you know, ways of spying on everyone and mind control, bizarre stuff. It was a crazy case.
Wow.
And your job then is to what? Determine what's the detriment in that situation?
Well, the detriment is, if you think about it for a second, you got a big house. It's a mansion. It sat on a hill on 3 acres. And you say this house is for sale, and it's got 9 bedrooms and 17 bathrooms and blah, blah, blah. And, oh, by the way, you know, 39 people committed mass suicide here. That's going
to
kind of put
off. When would you like to move in?
Yeah, that's going to put off the market. So believe it or not, I'm the guy that has to measure what that social stigma is, the effect that that's going to have on the price.
Oh. I think that's just fascinating. Measuring the economic impact of social stigma.
Yeah.
You did that as well in the O.J. Simpson case?
I did. I worked on O.J. You name a case. I wrote a textbook, and for that reason, I get about every case that comes along.
You also did it in the JonBenet Ramsey case.
I did. Ramseys were actually clients of mine, although I never met them directly. But, yeah, they had the same issue with the crime of and the loss of their daughter, so forth. There were issues of, you know, how that was going to affect their house value. They wanted to move. Well, they did move to Atlanta. So I had to measure that damage.
Is there any recourse for people in that situation? I mean, at some point, do you just say, let's just tear this down? And can insurance help? Is there do you protect yourself against that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's a good question, Mark. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. Sometimes insurance will cover it. Sometimes you can, you know, if the broker lied to you and you bought a house, I've seen that many times where people buy homes and it wasn't disclosed that there had been a homicide there. Mm-hmm. You can sue them. It just depends on the case. But obviously, if I'm there to measure it, they're trying to get, you know, the numbers for some reason, tax write-offs or something.
In those three cases where you're looking at a private residence, do you know, did somebody buy the property and live in it?
Yes, in each case, with O.J. Simpson, that house was sold. I met the guy that bought it. He was an attorney, an intelligent guy. He bought it, lived there happily. JonBenet Ramsey, that property sold. The Heaven's Gate Mansion, it did sell. It was bulldozed and redeveloped with a new house. The problem is with bulldozing these properties, and it happens here and there, is that the stigma goes to the site. So you may tear it down or build something new, but people are still going to point at whatever you rebuild and say, you know, like, that's what happened on that site.
Right.
Right.
So you're not that much further ahead.
Right. Right. The ghosts are there. They're not.
Is there a statute of limitations for disclosure?
Yes. Good. Legal question, Amanda. In California, there's...
She's a dropout lawyer.
Oh, good. The statute in California is 3 years, unless it's an AIDS-related death. There's different provisions. Mm-hmm. California or New York has the same kind of strict disclosure laws. About half the states have disclosure laws, and about half are what we call caveat emptor, buyer beware.
Right.
Yeah.
Buyer beware. Got to ask the right questions.
Yeah.
Buyer beware.
You sure do.
Yeah.
When you go to these sites, Randy, and you walk through these communities, and I'm assuming when you're retained to do the work that you do, that you spend a great deal of time in these communities. So whether you're working on Hurricane Katrina or the BP oil spill or 9/11 in New York City, What do you find about the people who are living in these literally disastrous situations?
Well, I've given a lot of thought to that question. I do spend a lot of time. I think with Hurricane Katrina, I went there probably 15, 16 times. And I like to get, I don't know how to describe it better than just say, I like to get the vibe. I like to get the vibe of the community, the people, the sense of resilience. You can have the same disaster in two different communities and they're reacted to two very different ways. I had a case where there was a sinkhole in Louisiana, and it was about a quarter mile, half a mile away from all the houses. But the neighborhood got irate. There were protests. There were signs in the people's yards, lawsuits. It was a really nasty thing about the sinkhole. And in my research, I went to Florida and found a sinkhole that had swallowed up half a shopping center. I went to this guy that owned a coffee shop and was chatting with him. I said, are you upset about this sinkhole? Because there's literally a sinkhole in the back parking lot. He says, oh, no, every year we have a big party. We call it Cinco de Mayo. same disaster, two different communities. One community's, you know, all upset, and the other community's, laughing about it.
We're going to get to the book later, Randy, but it's one of the things that you talk about in your book, right, is that there's an event, and then there's our reaction to the event. And depending on how we react to the event, is going to have a tremendous amount to say about the outcome of the event, yes?
Absolutely. A lot of people blame events, and really the evaluation or the blame, however you want to put it, is more with our reactions, not the event itself.
So I think one of the things that you've looked at in your book is, why does one community react one way and another community might react a different way to that event, in a way that one choice may move the community actually forward and closer together, and another reaction may actually divide the community and be detrimental, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. There are healthy ways of dealing with difficult situations, and there are unhealthy ways to actually make the situation worse. And, you know, along with working on these hundreds of cases comes a lot of time in an airplane to think about these things and kind of the social consequences. And I've been given really what I consider a privilege of having access not just to these sites of disasters, but more importantly to the people behind the headlines and talking to them. I felt it was very important that I meet this privilege with the responsibility of studying it and coming up with and kind of evaluating how it all kind of works.
Can I ask you this, Randy? I don't want to get into politics or sidetracked here, but there's a huge reaction going on in America about the event of Donald Trump being elected president. How do you see the reaction of the country right now to that event?
Well, I think some people are handling the whole election in a healthy way, and some people are handling it very poorly. I did not vote for Trump, and frankly, I didn't vote for Hillary. I vote independent. I voted for Johnson, just full disclosure. I thought they were, frankly, two very poor candidates, and but that aside, politics aside, I've accepted the fact that he's the president, and I think that I'm rooting for him now that he's successful. I would root for Hillary if she won, but she didn't. So I think we got to just move on in healthy ways and accept things where they are. I didn't vote for the guy, but I hope he's successful. I love the country.
Right. One thing that is not going to change is the election. Right.
Right, and getting throwing bricks through windows and rioting and carrying on and whining, complaining, that's not a path to success.
All right, you did a TED Talk.
I did.
What was your TED Talk?
Cool.
It was on Me, We, Do, Be. It was up at the Covey Center up in Provo, Utah. It was really an honor because Covey was a hero of mine. He's a mentor of mine, and so that was pretty crazy because I've given hundreds of speeches all over the world, but you have a podium and you have PowerPoints, but a TED Talk, you're on this little red dot and you don't move off of it. And then you got this spotlight on you and it's every word is memorized for 15 minutes straight. I don't think any Hollywood actor could do it right in one take, 13 minutes of pure memorization, but it was fun.
You have nothing with you when you do your TED Talk? You're just up there?
Nothing. You have no teleprompter. You have no notes. You have nothing. You're on this little red dot, and they say, don't move off the dot.
You present a lot of things, though. I mean, you're in many respects, you're a professional presenter. You live for it, right?
I do love to present stuff. I like to be presentation-friendly and with charts and graphs, but with With a TED Talk, it's a different dynamic, and you're really on the spot. And for the one time, I can get in front of a crowd of thousands and not feel any nervousness whatsoever. But TED Talks are different because of the lack of all the crutches of teleprompters and notes.
Do you know, I would just say the same thing. You know, I spent 20 years working as a stage actor.
Oh.
Right. And so I love it. You know what I mean? Like 50 people, 500 people, 5,000 people, and you know, get up on this stage and say, we're going to bring these people to their knees. But if you take me off of the stage and you put me in a room with like five people and turn a camera on, I can't breathe. What do you think that says about my need to be acknowledged by lots of people?
I'm going to have to evaluate that before I render a diagnosis.
All right. Did you knock it out of the park, the TED Talk?
I felt like it went well. I was very happy with it.
All right. The book is called Me, We, Do, Be. The author is Dr. Randy Bell. He's our guest this morning right here on Friendship Show. We're going to take a quick music break, and when we get back, we're going to dive into why this book and what it's all about. We'll be back right after this. Our guest this morning is Dr. Randy Bell. The book is called Me, We, Do, Be, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. This is what Stephen Covey has to say about the book. I think most people know who Stephen Covey is, right?
Seven Habits
of Highly Effective People.
Yes.
Which I don't know, we can talk to Dr. Bell about it. He's probably written 10 or 12 books, would be my guess. Here's what he has to say about Me, We, Do, Be, though. This book can not only enrich and improve your life and give you peace of mind, but doing so can save you from the destructiveness, dissatisfaction, and danger of a life floundering to and fro like a ship without a rudder. Backed by research and highly practical, this book is tremendously relevant today. High praise indeed, Randy, from Stephen Covey.
I was very grateful for that. Yeah.
Wow, that's really cool.
How many books has Stephen Covey written? Lots, right?
Lots. I love them all. I'm a big fan.
All right. This is called The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits is the subtitle to this book. The four cornerstones are Me, We, Do, and Be, yes?
Yes.
Can you tell us about the four cornerstones and what they mean?
Sure. Just like the four legs of a table, the four cornerstones, you know, make a stable foundation. And the me cornerstone is our thinking. It's everything intellectual, philosophical, and spiritual. So in other words, everything we think, believe, and feel is the me cornerstone. It's everything that kind of makes us me. Then switching to we is our relationships with other people. It's our sociological interconnectedness is early. I can't even talk with other people. It's our communication, our culture is everything in the we. Do is productivity. In economics, we call it land, labor, and capital, but it's taking care of our money, taking care of our health. It's our to-do lists, things like that. Taking care of our space, our workspace, our home space is do. And then B is the final cornerstone. That's what makes us uniquely human. Because that's where we can progress and set goals and achieve something and create our own legacy, whatever that happens to be for our own interests and our own style.
That's our vision?
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of where we're going. Yeah.
And this is the foundation. You have to have these four things as a foundation to move effectively, peacefully, directionally in the world?
Absolutely. If you look at the life of any great achiever, you will see this pattern, me, we, do, be. The first thing that a great achiever will do is figure out who they are, and they will really have their act together in terms of what's in their own head, what their attitudes, what their passions are, and so forth. Then they will move over and connect with the right team, the right people, and then they'll get to work, And then they'll finally take it to a new level and really go for the stars, whatever that is for them.
Can we go through these four things as quickly as we can? And so how do you achieve me? How do I understand who I am? And my problem oftentimes is that it changes.
Yeah, and that's not so much a problem. I think that might be a benefit.
Might be my first problem, right?
I'm very careful in the book not to be preachy and not to be self-righteous and not to tell people what to do. I just simply lay out that, hey, here are the four cornerstones, and you fill in the blanks the way you want to make them. But it is essential that I don't care who you are. You got to have me, we, do, be in place to be successful, however you define success. But, I just say that it's important that we, you know, with the me cornerstone, we get the information, we get the data, we go to school, we learn whatever, however we want to define that. Philosophically, we need to take a stand for something. Don't be wishy-washy. And if you believe something, stand up and say it. You know, don't hide it. And also be conscientious of your feelings. We talk about spirituality, which, you know, when I'm talking to business leaders, they're like, what are you talking about? People get a vibe for the business, you know, a feel for the business. That's what spirituality is. It's how you feel. So combine that all together and you have a nice solid me cornerstone.
Don't you love that when you walk into a business, right? And I understand that lots of times we equate success with, you know, successful business and money and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I think you would say, you know, there's other ways to achieve success. It's not all measured by that. But don't you love it when you walk into a business and like you said, like you get a feel for that business. Like there's a heart here. There's a soul here. These people are connected in a way that's moving everything forward and you feel part of it, right?
Right. And you really can get a sense of that feeling. You're absolutely right. And I see so many toxic situations that I really, you know, pay attention to that, to those feelings. And I try and get the vibe of the whole case that I'm working on, because it helps me. That's, you know, just to look at it as an economics and compute the numbers, or just money and wealth, that's important. I'm not putting it down, but it's only part of the equation.
Right? We all know a lot of people with lots of money who are not happy
or successful. I have many clients who are billionaires. They're all millionaires, multimillionaires. But some of them are very happy and some of them are quite miserable.
Right.
You can see it. Sure.
So me is not about there's a right way for me to be. It's just understanding who I am and being okay.
Yeah. And I let people in the book define success however they want to define it. I don't try and take people down a path and say my way is the right way, and self-righteousness. I'm not into that.
All right. Relationships. I have to tell you, here's another, I don't want to say problem for me, but perhaps an area where I could improve.
Well, we all need, you know, it's all about improvement. And the fact that, you know, people ask those questions, I think is really healthy to say, how can I improve? Because, you know, fortunately, I have a terrific wife. I have four kids that are great. I have, you know, great friends. But also in the book, I talk very frankly about toxic relationships. And toxic, you know, the narcissists, the sociopaths, the top kind of, you know, things that cause so much problems and so many disasters. I kind of identify them so we can stay away from it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I think it's essential to identify toxic people and just saying, you know what, I'm not buying into your crazy. I'm out of here. Bye.
I think, you know what, I think that's really interesting, right? Because at the beginning, we were sort of relating your experience as a damage economics expert, working with people in a disastrous situation, and how did those situations come about? And so you're saying that in those situations, someone has lost their sense of me.
Yeah.
And they've lost their sense of we.
Yeah, a lot of disasters start. Well, I'll tell you a quick story. I was at Chernobyl, and to make this whole connection, answer that, I was at Chernobyl. I had a letter of invitation. I walk into this. When you get to Chernobyl, there's this military outpost that protects the world from this epicenter, which is very dangerous. It's radioactive. And I go in there, and it's about lunchtime. I hand over my paperwork. In the former Soviet Union, everything takes forever. So we're sitting around, and all these military guys have machine guns over their shoulders, and they bring out sandwiches and vodka. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but machine gun and vodka, one in one hand and one in the other, seems really stupid. And you know what? You know what? I don't think it's a coincidence that the world's biggest nuclear disaster occurred in this culture. You know, that's where I saw the connection between bad behavior and bad results.
Can we?
Wow. Yeah,
seriously.
Pretty
that's
clear
where,
there.
That's where I woke up. It's more than numbers here. There's behavioral issues.
All right. How do we get a stronger we, or what should we be paying attention to and looking for? And we toxic relationships step aside.
Yeah. Don't try and fix people. Let people work through their stuff. But you know, identify the toxic stuff. But going to the positive side, I think the great way to have friends is be a friend. You know, make your own fun. If you're not having fun, decide to do something, invite someone to join in with you, those kinds of things.
I'm all about it, right? Again, I would just say, when you work at a place or you walk into a place and you see and feel that people are having fun, it's like it's energizing, right? It's contagious.
It is, and you get the vibe, and like I say, stay away from the negative stuff. Some people are drawn into it, you know, like horror movies and watching the news, which is always depressing. You know, I flip that stuff off. I like positive stuff.
Me too.
Yeah, you know, and I like helping people. You know, like the Friendship Shelter, people have a lot of problems. I'm there to help, but we don't have to be dreary about it.
Right.
You know, have fun.
It's all about recovery. It's all about moving forward. It's not about wallowing in your misery.
Right. And I tell the people at the homeless shelter, by the way, I say, you know what? We all have a story. I have a story. I say, I'm not interested in your story. Don't tell me your story. Let's talk about where we are today and where we're going, and let's have fun. And I think they really enjoy the fact that they are being spoken to as adults, and being spoken to in with positive, constructive stuff rather than wallowing the misery.
Right, exactly. Because we could go around the room, and I guarantee you, if what you want to discuss is my failures, I could chew up. Right. I could chew up a piece of time.
We could all wallow in the past.
Right.
Oh yeah.
So let's get off of that and let's talk about let's talk about what we're going to do next. Cornerstone number three is do.
Yeah, do. I mean, that's the stuff you just got to do. We gotta eat right. We got to exercise. We've got to take care of our money and budget. We got to keep our rooms clean. That's just the stuff we got to do. And there's no way around it. We're going to be what good is having money, or what good is having friendships if we don't take care of our health, those kinds of things.
I've said this many, many times, so many times that people probably get sick of hearing it. But I've designed and run quite a few programs that for lots of different things. And I've always said that if we can't get the dishes cleaned and the beds made, we have nothing to build on here, right?
Yeah.
If we can't take care of what's immediately around us, how are we going to take care of anything outside of us?
Exactly. And that's why in the book I talk about some things that are kind of shocking to people. I say, you know, make your bed in the morning. You know, I'm talking, you know, the audience is, the book's written for an adult audience, but you know what? Have some self-pride and take care of your stuff.
Now I'll tell you this though, right? Because I've read the book and I went to someone and I said, here's some really fascinating things where you talk about the habits of successful people. I said, one of them is make your bed. Or, and I think that there's some conclusion that you draw on it. I'm exaggerating for effect. That's what I do. But it's something like people who make their bed are like 50 times more likely to earn $1 million or more.
Yeah. I forget the exact statistic, but there is a direct correlation between making your bed and being a millionaire.
Right. And so I said that to someone and they said, "What? I make my bed every day. I've been making my bed every day for 30 years.
Make beds for other people then."
I said, well, there might be a couple other things you need to do along with
it's
that.
It's all imbalanced. My wife, when I wrote that part of the book, did that research, she says, you know, when we go to hotels, I'm going to go up and down the halls and make everybody
make a bed. Make a bed. That would be like a tremendous sort of like socially kind of performance art sort of thing. If you just like went around and like how many beds could you make for other people?
There you go. But you're robbing them of opportunities for them to do well. So let them make their bed.
Right. Cornerstone number four is B.
B is the fun cornerstone, because once we have our own me, we have our attitudes and our heads in the right place and we got good relationships and we're taking care of our do stuff, B is the fun stuff. That's where we set goals. That's where we go for it. that's where we create something new. We do some artwork, we write a book, we get into volunteering. That's what really brings us alive. Think about it. Animals have me, we, and do cornerstones. Animals think, they have social relationships. They make their nests and they get their food and all that stuff. But animals are doing the same thing today in the San Diego Zoo today as they were doing when I was living in Fullerton, California. My parents took me there in when I was 5 years old. Animals have me, we, and do. But B is what makes us human, because in the same time that's gone by, man has gone on to the moon, and all, you know, we have technology in our pockets, all kinds of crazy new things because of the B cornerstone.
Mm, we can create.
Yeah, we can create. That's what's fun about the B cornerstone.
I love the B cornerstone.
Yeah.
Right.
But if we just are stuck in the B cornerstone, we kind of wander. We need all four. That's what I cut.
Well, I would
emphasize.
Say it's interesting. It's because you're saying like these are the four cornerstones and everything in balance, because you're right. If I were to spend too much time in one of these quadrants, it would probably be in the B category, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I say to people. It's like, you know, if you need a crazy cool idea, I've got volumes full of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have written the first page of like 50 blockbuster movies.
I love it. Yeah.
It's getting it done seems to be the whole
thing. It's all four. You got to have all four.
All right.
You really do.
That's Dr. Randy Bell. He's the author of Me, We, Do, Be. He's our guest this morning on Friendship Show. We're going to take a quick break right now, but when we get back, you have an interesting relationship with you and your family and Leo Fender.
Yes.
The creator of all things Fender, amps and guitars.
Yes.
Cool.
Let's take a break. When we get back, we're going to learn more about that. You're listening to The Friendship Show on KX93.5. We'll be back in just a minute.
Closing time, open all the doors and let you out into the world. Closing time, turn all of the lights on over every boy and every girl. Closing time.
Welcome to the Friendship Show here on KX93.5. Amanda Pointer is here running the board for us.
Hello.
Doing a great job this morning.
Hey, thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much. Dr. Randy Bell has been our guest this morning. He's the author of Me, We, Do, Be, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. Your life, Randy, was impacted by none other than Leo Fender of Fender Guitars. What's your relationship to the Fender family?
Well, my dad worked for Fender for many years. He loved the job. I grew up in Fullerton, and my mom lives about three streets away from Mrs. Fender. Leo passed away, but I've had the privilege of getting to know Mrs. Fender. She's just a remarkable woman, and Leo I've always considered as a hero of mine. Think about it. I mean, Rolling Stone came out with an article of the 100 top guitarists in history, and I went through meticulously and found that about 90 out of 100 of those top guitarists played a Fender on stage.
That's not coincidence.
That's because he developed a really brilliant instrument, and it was through a lot of work.
We were talking about that before the show, right? Because Leo Fender and your father were not musicians.
Neither one were. Leo Fender went to Fullerton College for 2 years as a mechanical engineer, and he opened up the plant at 500 South Raymond in Fullerton, turned on the lights and started a legacy, developed the Stratocaster in that building. And the last one out of that building that turned off the lights was my dad. So they're both my heroes. My dad and Leo are just greats. They were what I call quiet giants, because they quietly went about their work and built something, you know, huge.
Wow. Well, right. I mean, it really is incredible when you think about these two engineers who weren't musicians, went about designing and building guitars.
Yeah.
To create this, you know, international, in, you know, lifelong legacy and platform,
right,
for people to be able to share their voice.
Right. And Mrs. Fender, who is just a sweetheart, she shared with me that Leo felt very compelled. He had no musical ability. He didn't even tune the guitars, honestly. But he felt very compelled to design an instrument for what he considered angels. He called musicians angels because his position, his philosophy, it was a life was a tough place. The world was a tough place, and music made it better. And he wasn't called to be a musician, but he was called to make the instruments for those angels that made life better.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
Me, we do be.
Yep, there it is.
Yeah.
Talk about understanding, right?
Yeah. And Leo followed that philosophy. Me was his mindset, his mission. He had a team. My dad was privileged to be on that team. He was talking about a hard worker. Mrs. Fender said that when they were on a cruise or something at the captain's table, anyone that saw his name got invited to, you know, the captain's table. He'd be over there drawing a guitar on a napkin with a new design. You know, he was constantly thinking about how to make those instruments better.
You also said that, you know, sort of at a point when, you know, Fender was an international brand in business and everyone wants a Fender guitar.
Yeah.
That he was living in a trailer.
He was living in a mobile home. He was a very practical guy. He was not trying to impress anybody. He knew who he was. He knew what he wanted to do. And it wasn't about being flashy and being a, consumption and all that stuff, materialism. He had a mission, and he created an international empire, and it never went to his head.
Talk about understanding success, right?
Yeah. Leo Fender and Abraham Lincoln, I put those people in the same category. They're just people I really admire.
Oh, my gosh. That should be a new Broadway musical. Something about Leo Fender and Abraham Lincoln in the same musical play.
Yeah. My buddy wrote a book called Lincoln on Leadership. A great book on leadership. Love the book. I want to write a book, Leo on Leadership, because Leo Fender had it going on.
That would be. You should write that book.
I'm really contemplating.
You're the only person who probably could write that book.
I'm thinking about it seriously. Yeah,
with great pictures.
Great pictures and rock stars. You know, the rock stars would come through the plant, and my dad was in research and development, and it didn't care who you were. It didn't care if you had a tattoo, of a tarantula on your face. If you were a kind person, my dad would sit there for hours to tweak your instrument to get the right vibe. That's the kind of people that ran Fender in its beginning years.
Wow.
In your book, one of the things you talk about are developing habits. We're almost out of time, Randy. But if I were going to today develop three new habits that would help me develop four cornerstones, what three things should everyone be doing?
Well, with the me cornerstone, reading is a really, important cornerstone. Just keeping informed, reading something that is spiritual or uplifting, motivational, however you want to describe it. Reach out to a friend. Keep those friendships alive. Make new friends, that kind of thing. Just talk to people. We talked about making your bed. A big one is, living within a budget. A lot of people, are so engrossed in materialism and stuff. And then the fourth idea I'd have is set a goal. Write down a goal. Don't daydream. Write it down. Stick it on the mirror of your bathroom and work at it little by little.
And say that I'm going to do this. And it doesn't have to be overnight, right?
Yeah, it's simple stuff. I mean, I've had the chance, the privilege, really, of being around the Fender thing and seeing that empire, done. And from my parents' house, you could see Disneyland. Disney was another guy. But I actually went to his office once. These were simple people that just did it little things day by day and created something enormous through really very simple activities. Like I said, they wrote down their goals and they stuck it on the bathroom mirror.
You talk about the power of reading a lot, that it is something that when you find people who have these four cornerstones and describe themselves as successful, one of the things that they all have in common is an interest in learning and reading.
An interest in learning. Some people are just not readers. I say, well, then just read one page a day. Don't kill yourself. But do something to get a little smarter every day. Yeah.
All right. That's Dr. Randy Bell. He's been our guest this morning. The book is called We Do Be, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. Dr. Bell, can people get this book if they want to?
Yeah, go to Amazon.com and just type in Me, We, Do, Be.
And there it is.
Amazing show. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.
All right. Up next is Tommy J. And Ida May. It looks like they've got a room full of people out here.
I know. It's going to be a good show.
There's going to be a concert in here, it looks like, later.
Some live music.
All right. We'll be back next week at 9 o'clock. You've been listening to The Friendship Show here on KX 93.5. Thanks for tuning in.